up. And we're here today with Lieutenant Gordy, Mr. Gordy, and my name is Paul Ortiz. First of all, Mr. Gordy, thank you so much for agreeing to take time out of your busy schedule to be interviewed. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Could you begin, sir, by telling me what your full name is, where you were born, and something about growing up?
Married Leonard Gordy, and I was born in Casita, Georgia, which is south of Columbus, Georgia. Mm-hmm. And my father was a farmer, and I was born in May the 23rd, 1917.
Mm-hmm. What was life like growing up in Georgia, Mr. Gordy?
Well, I was reared on a farm, and back then it was, you was expected to stay on the farm if you could. Mm-hmm. But my father sold his farm and came down to Florida in 1924. Mm. And I was about 7 years old. And we came to Florida in November of 1924, but my father had been down here about 6 months. He was, he had worked for Mr. Sherman in Panama City. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Sherman owned a sawmill up there. And my father was a kind of a millwright. Mm-hmm. And he helped Mr. Sherman build a farm, sawmill out of south of Okeechobee. Mm. At a little town called Sherman.
And so by then your whole family was living in that area?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And we lived there from 1924 to about 1928, and my father had lost a lot of money in the development of that down in there, in property and bought.
Oh, yes, sir. Oh, so many people did in the late 20s, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he decided to come up to North Central Florida, where he, Putnam Lumber Company had established over in Shamrock. Mm. And we came up there in 1929, the early part of 29. And he had a job with Putnam Lumber Company.
Okay.
From then up until the time of his death in 1932.
Okay.
And my mother carried him back to Casita and buried him in the church that they belonged to up there, mm-hmm. which is First Baptist Primitive Church in Casita, and he's buried down there.
What were your earliest childhood memories growing up, Mr. Gordy?
Well, I had a good life. My father, a little later on, in 1922, my brother was born, 5 years after I was. And my dad was like to carry his fishing and have, we just had a good time and we had a nice, good home. And I was going to school in Casita, and we lived about 6 miles out of Casita. And my dad bought me a horse, and I started riding my horse. And my grandfather, his father, was a doctor in Casita. And I'd ride my horse to school and leave it at grandpa's and feed him. My daddy'd carry corn up there.
Wow.
And I'd feed him.
Well, do you remember the name of your horse?
Charlie.
Charlie.
Yeah, and I tell you, I had a good time. I was growing up and getting where I could help my daddy, you know, on the farm. And my brother, little brother, would stay at home. And we had a good relationship together. And he and I had spent a lot of time together. And after my dad died, my mother was offered a position to manage the Putnam Lodge over there, which was a big house, was a hotel kind of, and dining room.
What town was that in, sir?
Shamrock. It's
on over, Shamrock, okay.
It's just about a mile past Cross City.
Okay, Cross City.
Yeah. But my mother told Mr. Hecker, he was the superintendent, she said, Mr. Hecker said, I appreciate that, but says, I'm going to try to give these boys of mine a good education. And said, I'm going to move over to Gainesville. And a year, let's see, we came to Gainesville in 1933. And my father died in 1932. We were there 2 years after he passed away. And we came to Gainesville, and my mother bought the place that we have now that me and my wife own. On Northwest 15th Street, right in front of University Press.
Oh, okay, okay.
A big white stucco house that was built in 1925.
Oh, I think I know that. That's a really nice house.
Well, it was my mother bought it and paid a an enormous sum for it at that time, but the Lord bless us, and Mama finally paid for it.
Uh-huh.
And we worked together, and I worked, Paul worked. He had a paper route in Gainesville, and carried Gainesville's son, and Mr. Torley, Warren Torley, was circulation manager. And I worked at A&P when A&P was down on the University Avenue just passed where the Mr. the attorney is on the corner across on First what's the street run east and west. Mm-hmm. And on that corner of First Street, the University Avenue is where A&P used to be.
Oh, okay, okay. I didn't know that the store was there.
And later on it moved, but I had the good work for Mr. Pritchett, and Mr. Pritchett, we didn't make much money then. Mm-hmm. But Mr. Pritchett could always ask me and tell me, he said, "Leonard, I want you to be here Saturday morning at 6 o'clock. And I'd be there.
Wow.
And I've always had a backed up my word. Mm-hmm. And he gave me a good reference and a good endorsement to the Mr. Grassley in Jacksonville. It was the head man at A&P division in Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. Told him, he says, "That boy make us a good manager."
Wow.
And I was managing A&P when I was 21 years old.
Wow, that's amazing. So you were managing the A&P in Gainesville?
No.
Or in Jacksonville?
In Mariana,
Florida. Oh, Mariana, Florida. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I went up there and I didn't even know anybody, didn't even know the supervisor. Uh-huh. Mr. J.C. Davis and Mr. Grassley says, "You don't know what the problem is, Leonard." And it was on account of a man checking short inventory.
Oh.
But he told me, he says, "Mr. Pritchett has really praised you because you already work and you did what I said to."
Okay.
And he said he told you could make a good manager. And Mr. Grassley said, "Well, we'll see." And one summer, I had to relieve 8 different managers for 2 weeks. And I had 8 stores to go to, and I'd never been in them before. Mm-hmm. And he said, "If you don't check your short inventory, I'll give you a job." And I said, he says, "You know what the difference is?" He says, "You know the difference between you money?" He says, "Sometimes A&P's money get mixed up with some of the men's money." I said, "Well, I won't have any trouble then, because I haven't gotten the money." Uh-huh. And I did. I checked. Did more business than some of the managers was doing. And I checked a good inventory on every one of them.
Okay. Mr. Gordy, what kind of values did your parents teach you when you were growing up? What were they trying to kind of instill in you?
Well, my dad and mother loved the church, and they had had a reputation of being good people. And if either one of them told you that they would do such and such, and they couldn't do it, then they would, they was man or woman enough to go to you and say, look, I can't do what I promised you to do, but says I will. And I've never taken a bankruptcy case. I've never been involved in not being honest with the government. I was a mail contractor in Gainesville here, contracted with the post office after I closed my business and, well, sold it, my business in Chipley, where I was living at that time. And I came back to Gainesville in 1966, in November of 66. Mm-hmm. And I haven't ever had any trouble. I've been honest and truthful about things. And my daddy gave me a whipping one time when I kind of misrepresented something. I didn't mean to. And he gave me one of the worst tannings I've ever had. And he said, son, don't ever do this. Says, be a man and say, yes, I did. And own up to anything you've done that's wrong. Mm-hmm. He said, because if I let you by with this, you won't ever forget it now that I've tanned you backside pretty good. Mm-hmm. And I never have either. Okay. But I had good parents, and they were just like anybody else long along at that time. Mm-hmm. My mother especially raised me and my brother after my father passed away. And He had an apoplexy. There was an aneurysm at that time in the back of his neck. He was a young man, 48 years old when he passed away. Mm. But I remember him like it was yesterday. Mm. But, and I tell you what, I've experienced things in my life that when I was in the war and I got shot down and I was captured by the German civilians. Mm. I got shot down on April the 29th in 1944. And had the plane got knocked out of formation. I was flying on a B-17. I was a bombardier. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have any fighter escorts or anything. We flew. I'd been to Berlin the day I got shot down. Had been there the day before. Mm-hmm. And I was supposed to go on to London with my crew, but I had kind of a bad day. And I told them, I said, fellas, y'all go ahead. And I had my pass in my pocket when the officer's day came by. And he came to the hut and he says, Gordy? And I said, yo. He said, you here by yourself? I said, yeah, where's your crew? I said, they're in London, where I'm going. It's 6:30 and going in on the train. Said, no, you're not, you're gonna fly.
Oh, no.
And I said, well, would you listen to this? I said, I don't understand this. But when you have a maximum effort, when at that time they had a maximum effort, anything that would fly, that flew. Mm-hmm. I was on a composite crew. Mm-hmm. Somebody I'd never flown with before. Mm-hmm. Didn't even know his name. Mm-hmm. Until I went down to the flight line that morning. And when they said Berlin, I said, oh my goodness. And well, it was a rough trip both times.
Mm-hmm. And you had no fighter escort?
No fighter escort.
So you were really vulnerable to ground fire or?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We got knocked out of formation and had one on fire and one. And just had one engine flying. We had two. We had one when we took off and got over the channel. They had the feather. And going in. And, but we, I'm fortunate to be here. Mm-hmm. And if it wasn't for a little, they were taking us down to the courthouse, they called it. Mm-hmm. And we were in Falkenberg, where we got shot down in Falkenberg. And I took a free fall from 24,000 feet because I had horror of being shot in the air. Mm-hmm. And the Germans were doing it. As a matter of fact, I saw killed two airmen coming down. But I was falling, and I fell until I started into the cloud cover.
Mm-hmm. They were shooting, the Germans were shooting people as they were coming down?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And well, we did the same thing, so. Mm-hmm. Why couldn't you can I couldn't criticize them for mm-hmm. doing something that we were doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. But I didn't do anything but thank this little German officer equivalent to ensign in the Navy. He hollered just a little louder and told them we had a rope around our necks.
The civilians were going to
hang us.
Uh-huh.
And he just out-talked them.
And this was in Falkenberg?
Yeah. There was me and eight other fellows.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even know.
So you came down in your parachute from 24,000 feet. The first thing is you see the German fighter planes are shooting at people in their parachute harnesses. What was going through your mind at that time? Were you?
Well, I said, we've done the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew we had too. But I said, Lord, I can't speak for anybody but myself. But you see the situation that we're placed in. And I have the faith that you can do anything. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate what you can do and do. Mm-hmm. So if you can do anything for us now, and we can survive, I'll give you the credit.
Where did you hit the ground, Mr. Gordy? Did you?
I hit on top of a German home. You know, they have real steep roofs on. And I fell off into the flower bed, and I had a shrapnel, a wound in my left thigh. And I couldn't walk. So they had a little wagon that they put me in, and one of the fellas pulled it for me when I was on the way to town. And they were right ready to hang us. And I couldn't blame them.
You couldn't blame them for wanting to hang you?
No, I couldn't blame them.
Were the other, how many men survived the shooting down of the plane?
There were, I don't know whether they were, I think there was only about four. Or maybe five. And I never did know who they were anywhere.
And Mr. Gordy, were you, was your B-17 shot down on the way to Berlin or on the way coming back?
On the way coming out.
Oh, on the way coming out.
Yeah, we were in a little old, just a little old town. Was about 90 miles southeast of Berlin.
Okay.
On the way back, and when it blew up, 2 minutes after I got out, and I know that there was three men dead, two waist gunners, and the co-pilot was dead.
So you were hit by flak or by a, do you remember?
Yeah, we got hit by flak, and of course we got shot up by the fighters too, German fighters. And they, but this little German's flyer himself, they had a flying field there.
Okay.
In this little town. And we got under his care, and he carried us out to his field, and then that's where they picked us up and took us down to Frankfurt on the Main.
Okay. And was that where the POW camp was?
No. I was in Stalag 3.
Okay.
Up at Sagen, Germany. I finally wound up that way. My brother was up there.
Oh, wow.
My brother got shot down in 1943 out in the on a raid to submarine pens up there, and they had orders not to bail out over the North Sea, but they had the same situation that we did, they didn't have, they had trouble and they got, Germans picked him up and finished him up. And he bailed out, pilot bailed out. And they floated around out there about 12 hours in the North Sea. Mm-hmm. He got his feet frozen and his hands frozen. Mm-hmm. But he was in Sagan then at that time when I got shot down. And when I got out of the interrogation in Frankfurt, I was about 2 months before I got shot. I stayed there in Frankfurt. Mm-hmm. As a POW, and then got interviewed, and so I just gave him a name, rank, and serial number. Mm-hmm.
What kinds of questions did they ask you?
Well, they said, they ask you, where are you from? And finally, the interrogator said to me, says, Gordy, why don't you just tell me where you're from? I said, I can't tell you that. You know it. Well, he said, I'll tell you where you're from.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And he says, you were a manager of an A&P in Marana, Florida. And he said, you just bought a new Chevrolet too, didn't you? And I didn't say anything. And he told me, he says, well, he said, you've done all right. He said, how come you're here now? I said, well, I'm a POW. And I said, I was wounded in combat. I got a piece of 20 millimeter through my thigh, my backbone, my thigh. And he said, well, you're lucky. I said, well, I don't call it luck. I call this intervention of the Lord. That's the reason I'm here and the rest of the guys too. And I said, I'd like to shake hands of that little old. But I don't know what his rank was. I never did find out. But he was equivalent to an ensign in the Navy. So he had some pull. He was pretty persuasive. And it's something, he believed in the Lord too. I could sense that. Mm-hmm.
That was in Falkenberg when the civilians were planning to hang you and your comrades.
You were?
No, when the civilians were trying to, the German civilians were going to.
Yeah, hang them. Yeah.
Did he have to, were you already, you were at the courthouse when this was going to happen. They were going to actually hang you at the courthouse.
Yeah, we were there.
Okay.
But this little German ensign, equivalent ensign, came around the corner and he told them right quick. He said, y'all doing the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. Of course, I couldn't say anything because I couldn't speak German. I could later on ask for a drink of water when I was on December the 27th. They took us and we was in the British and American officers camp at Sagan, mm-hmm. Germany, and they took us out, and we started on a march, a walk rather, to Moosburg. And they were trying to get us in the, into the foothills of the Alps and use us as bargaining power. So that's what this rumor was. But that was right in the middle of the wintertime. Snow was on the ground about 4 foot deep, and we left this camp at 10 o'clock at night. And the only thing I had was 10 bars of chocolate that I had, that I was taking with me, no food. And then the guards told us, says you have to stay on the trail. And it was four of us together. There was a banker from Flemington, Alabama, and one from Pensacola. And then a guy from Liverpool, New York, that his grandmother lived in Munich. When we was on the march to Moosburg. His grandmother lived in Munich. His name was Johnny Carl. And he could speak German like a master. And the other guy, fellow was from Jefuniak Springs. And so they let you have 10 minutes out of an hour to rest for about 15 minutes. Well, I lay down right on the ground and went right off to sleep just like that. And they said, "Get up, Gordy, let's go." And I said, "Y'all go ahead, I'll catch up with you." "No, we're not gonna leave you. You lay right here and be frozen to death. Get up." And Johnny Carl got a handful of snow and threw it in my face and rubbed it around like that and says, "Come on, wake up, let's go." And I said, "I'm tired, I want to sleep a little bit." "No, we're not going to leave you. Get up now. Get up and let's go." And so the three of them talking to me, I got up too. And I walked, I said, "All right, let's go, I'm ready." And I did. I didn't ever do that anymore. And I tell you that I had never been in a winter like that in my life. And I wasn't too fat either. I went in there weighing 175 pounds, and right then I weighed about 120 pounds.
You lost so much weight. And then coming from Florida and then being in the middle of the German winter.
Yeah. Well, we never did have any hot water to take a bath in. We took a bath in cold water. And it was a $100 bet that you couldn't stay in it 3 minutes. Under 3 minutes. I tried it one time. I didn't even stay in it a minute. Cold War. But I tell you what, I've had a lot of experience in these things, and I didn't want to talk about them. And when we got home and got ready to get out, my brother, he came into the camp. He was up at Regensburg, which was about 50 miles from where we were. He had frozen feet and he had to catch the Red Cross train, mm-hmm. come down. And they got off in Regensburg and walked. I believe they brought him down in a truck some kind. Mm-hmm. But at one time they had 85,000 prisoners there, mm-hmm. in Mooseburg.
Did you know, Mr. Gordy, that your brother had been already a POW? Did you know that, or did you think he had been killed?
No, I knew he was. He was a. Was a. My mother got a telegram that I'd been killed from the War Department. And it had, I didn't open my parachute. And see, they didn't know that I got out. And when I started into the cloud cover, I pulled my ripcord and I was in the air 3 minutes. Mm. And I was landing on top of this German home, slipped off and fell, and fell in some shrubbery and down. And the German guard was there, but the civilians was there too. And we all was wound up together. I didn't even know any of the men that I was flying with was there. And they began to talk about what they was gonna do. And they finally found the rope, and it was self-explanatory what they was going to do.
You actually had the rope around your neck.
Well, about this much over. So it was. It was, I could gather what they was going to do without being told. Mm-hmm. But that's the thing that I promised the Lord, that if he saw fit to get, that I could get out of that, that's, I dedicate my life to him from then on. And I've lived up to it.
Mr. Gordy, when you were forced on this walk to the POW camp, about how many miles? It sounds like it was a long march that you had to go on.
I don't know how far it was. But we left on the 27th of December, and we were on the road from then, and the only building that we were in from then until about there. 10th of April was the first stop that we was in a building was in Krakow, Germany, down on the Czech border.
Mm-hmm.
And we went into this engine room and electrical place. They had these long, low boilers. From the time you walked in the front door until you walked out the back door, took 30 minutes to walk up and down those, around those things,
mm-hmm.
to get warm. And then you were out again.
Mm-hmm.
And we lived on chocolate for about a month or two before we began to trade chocolate to German people for a chicken. And sometimes we'd stop and find wood and maybe kill the chicken and roast it.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that.
Did most of the men lose a lot of weight? And
well, most of them had lost a lot of weight from the time they'd been in, because they only, you got about two or three little old potatoes about that size.
Very, very tiny, very small.
Yeah. And we would get Red Cross parcels. We finally started getting Red Cross parcels after I had been there about 2 months, I guess, in the camp before I got some. But the Germans did the best they could. They didn't have it. They didn't have it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they surely wasn't going to give it to us. But when I got to the camp, my brother told me that I had come down then from about 190 pounds, I reckon, to about 175 pounds when I got in the camp. He says, Leonard says, I know you like to eat. He said, but don't ever say anything about eating. Says we're all in the same boat.
Mm-hmm.
And when we got the American parcels, they had spam and coffee. And it was just a regular Red Cross box,
mm-hmm.
that they sent. And you take a 12-ounce can of Spam and had 15 men in a room, and you was going to divide that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you did the best you could anyway with what you had to work with. And it was pretty heavy, and two of them looked like the one piece of ham was a little, pork was a little bigger than the other. They always cut the cards, and that's the way they settled it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I never did say anything about it, because I wanted to lose weight. And I did. I walking around the compound that we was in.
Uh-huh.
We had four. It was a north and south camp and the east and west camp. And they had about 5,000 or 6,000 POWs in each one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the one that broke a tunnel.
Oh, dug a tunnel. People dug a tunnel.
Yeah.
To try to escape.
Yeah. And did escape. They got 50 something, two or three, I think it was, out.
Uh-huh.
They made a picture of it. I forget the name of it now. I saw it several times. I can't remember now. I've got Parkinson's now. I've had it 5 years. And I've fallen 19 times out in this yard.
Mm.
Never broken a bone.
That's amazing. And
Lord bless me. But...
Because I was going to ask you, Mr. Gordy, how, I mean, once you're in the camp, if the men were able, if you were able to organize yourselves in order to survive, like how that worked.
Well, we had a chance to play ball and stuff like that, you know, and recreation, but the camp was pretty long ways around it. On the inside, and we used to walk. My brother and I used to walk around it about twice every day when we could. And but we played ball, and we were the only brother combination that we know of that was able to survive, that were prisoners of war.
That is so incredible, Mr. Gordy, that your brother and you were in the same camp. It's just, I cannot get over that.
Well, you know, they had the Geneva Convention. They said that up to first cousins could ask to be together, and they'd use it granted.
Uh-huh.
But my brother was in this camp, and somebody told him, says, what's your brother's name, Paul? He said, well, I don't know why he's going. Says he's Leonard, but he always signs it, says Marion Leonard. But said he always signs it ML. Said he doesn't like to write much. And it says he's got a good handwriting, but says he don't like to write Marion Leonard. And I signed a check. It's ML now. But Marion L is what I'm going by there.
Mm-hmm.
Going by now. But,
In the camp, Mr. Gordy, there had been this big escape, you know, 50 people had, did you and your brother ever talk about trying to escape or?
No, we never did get in. We had a chance to listen to news,
mm-hmm,
on at night. We had a little radio that you listen to BBC, you know, and get the news from England about where it was. And
do the Germans allow you to have that radio, or is that
something? No, no, no.
Okay, didn't, I didn't think they would.
They wouldn't allow you to have it, and we didn't get too much food from the Germans.
Uh-huh.
We got whatever they gave us, we were thankful for it and didn't grumble about it. I've never been much to grumble about anything much,
mm-hmm,
myself.
But you were listening, you were able to kind of secretly listen to the BBC. Could you kind of tell that the way the war was going, or were you?
Yeah, well, we knew how it was going. We could, they'd have the guys that were getting the transmission of the news and on the radio. They'd usually go around and they always stay ahead of the guards, you know, or somehow or another slip around. And didn't let them know what they was doing. And they wasn't supposed to be out in another barracks anyway. But we learned that they bombed so-and-so and so-and-so and happened. Mm-hmm. But they kept up on it pretty good with us. But we had to be real particular, mm-hmm. because we were real lucky to get out of the situation that we were in. And because I tell you what, we always dreaded getting the higher military that was taking prisoners of war out, you know, anyway. And they get you and take you out. Now they kill that first bunch of those guys that graduated, I mean, broke the thumb and got out. The Germans got all of them except one.
Oh, and they executed them?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you know any of those men, or?
Oh, no, I didn't know any of them. I didn't know. I was a complete stranger in that camp. I didn't know anybody except my brother, Harley, mm-hmm. and this boy, Johnny Carl. I was talking to him one day about how the Germans treated me down at Frankfurt on the Main. He said interrogation, and he said they had a good deal going on over here before the war. And as a matter of fact, this one he told me about, that I was telling him, that told me that I was manager of an A&P. And he said he was making some of the best money you ever made in your life there. Mm-hmm. Well, I said, yeah, I know what I had signed a contract with him to stay with them at least 5 years. Mm-hmm. But I didn't, because I volunteered to go in service. Mm-hmm. But and I had a job to come back to when I came back.
And the question I was going to ask you, Mr. Gray, how did they know that you had been a manager at the A&P?
I don't know how they know, and goes, I couldn't find out. Uh-huh. But Johnny Carl told me that when he got interrogated, he said he just gave his name, rank, and serial number, and that's all I did.
Yeah.
Name, rank, and serial number. Mm-hmm. I never volunteered anything. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how they knew, but he had it right. I didn't tell him that he was right, but he did. He had it right.
Yeah, you're the person who interrogated you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mr. Gordy, besides the lack of food and other things, were there other examples of the American POWs being mistreated by the guards or?
No, they didn't mistreat you. And when we were on this walk, I tell you what, I learned a lot by just looking at the face of the German people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They know, I know they had, that they was thinking about us the way we were having to go without food, you know, and without having a place to call home, bed, sleeping, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, the General Patton was the general that liberated us. I had a cousin that was his aide.
Mm-hmm.
He graduated from West Point and he was in the ROTC in college but me and my brother both volunteered. My brother was going to the University of Florida when he volunteered.
Hmm.
And I was managing this A&P in Marana and making the best money I had ever made.
Wow. Did you volunteer after Pearl Harbor or?
Yeah.
Do you remember what was your reaction when you first heard about it?
Well, I knew they was gonna get me. I wasn't married or anything that way. And so I told Mr. Davis, I said, Mr. Davis, I'm gonna have to volunteer because I'm not gonna be trapped. I want, and two, I said, I want to get in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a pilot by the name of Henson in Marana that taught me to fly, and I wanted to be a pilot,
mm-hmm.
but I couldn't be one. And you see that with the Norden bomb sight. Yeah, I've always been able to work pretty good with my hands, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was real easy to move.
Mm-hmm.
The controls, and you're controlling the plane when you turn the bomb sight on.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a bombing run of about 50 miles. And then they got where they was letting you drop on the lead bombardier, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the pilot told me, said, Gordy, how you can handle it so easy like that? And he said, you don't jerk and snatch it around. And I said, well, Mr. Chisholm, I've been a pilot, and I've got about 45 hours in a little old Cub.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, you can land them in a peanut patch or anything. But I says, I think when I go in service, I said, if I can be a pilot, I said, I like that better, but they lost a bunch, they lost a bunch of planes, you know, and right there, and I had gotten out, and I was graduated from Bombardier School at Childress, Texas, and I came home on a 90-day furlough. And I was went down to MacDill Field in Tampa. And I was stationed there a while. Then I transferred. I can't think of the name. I've forgotten it. The field in Tampa, it was a B-17. Field, I've forgotten it.
We can get the name of that. But it was a B-17 field.
Yeah.
Okay. I can look that up. And that was a really difficult skill to learn. I've read a lot of people who never were able to master it. Being a bombardier, that was very difficult.
Yeah, well, it was. And a lot of people, I never roped anything in. I had a good drop schedule, and I didn't cheat either. I laid it on the line. And I could do it too.
How many missions did you participate in?
Seven missions.
Seven missions. And what was the first one, Mr. Gordy, do you remember?
First one was to Ham, Germany. And then we flew, the next one was to France. And I can't remember them all. Now,
what were the targets?
In Ham, Germany, we was on a rail target was a rail yard.
Wow, that's a difficult target, a rail yard.
And and then we went to the ball bearing factory too. That's the one that lost so much. Swinford? No.
Was the ball bearing factory in Germany?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was in Germany. And, but we flew it in the daytimes and the English flew at night. But we didn't have anything to stay with us and protect us from the Germans when we started. And I tell you what, the Germans had good firepower anyway. They had guns that could reach you. Even 25,000 feet, and they could track you a little bit, and they could put one on you too, two 90s. But whenever we got the B-17s with two nose 50s in there. It was in the G's, I think it was, that we got the first one. But there ought to be some other way to, I don't like war. I don't like it. And I said, I don't think I'll ever, I would have done what I had to do. if I hadn't got in the Air Force, I'd probably got into the Marines. But somebody, and I said, I never walk into one. I didn't want to walk in it. Because I got a bad knee, and I still got it. I got it playing football in Orlando in 1936.
Mr. Gerdy, you mentioned earlier that you flew on the mission that you were, your plane was shot down. You did not have a fighter cover protection. Did on any of the missions, the seven missions that you flew, did you ever have fighter protection? Wow.
Didn't have any.
Was that a strategic decision that was made, or there were not enough fighter planes, or?
They didn't have too many at that time to go. We've never been on a mission with one. I wasn't. But later in the war, after I got shot down, I got shot down in April of 44. And I was liberated in April 29th in 45.
What was that like, Mr. Gerdy, to be liberated?
Well, I tell you what, to me, General Patton, you couldn't talk to him. He came into camp, and my cousin was looking for me and my brother, and later, he found us. He found out where we were. And he came and took us. They went up out of the camp up to Regensburg to meet General Patton and ask him that they wanted his permission to move some of them out of
to move some of the POWs out.
Out of that, and he gave him, he said, no, I mean, you can't move up. He was salty talking, you know. And he didn't fiddle around the bush. He told them in Tennessee language just exactly what they could do, and that was nothing. He said, 9 o'clock in the morning, you look up on the side of that mountain down, there's going to be 9 tanks out there. And I had a cousin that was leader of those 9 tanks that day. And he had 5 tanks shot out from him. And during the war.
Wow.
And he died about 5 years ago. And I went to his funeral up in Dawson, Georgia. His name was Thad Hudson. And He told Thad, he says, get over there, be there at 9 o'clock and ready to go.
General Patton said that.
Yeah, he told Thad to have the tanks over there. And they got over there that morning at 9 o'clock. We looked up there And we were in this big horseshoe on this river. The river came in, wound around there. Uh-huh. And I couldn't believe there was 80,000 people in there either. Uh-huh. But there was anybody, any kind of soldier you wanted. Mm. From New Zealand and Australia, India, any kind. Mm. And he told them no uncertain terms. They had a P-38 and a P-47 came just dilly-dallying around, you know, and and getting their body up. And they had to fire right across us into this town. And it had a platoon bridge going in and one going out. And we were right about 12 miles above Munich. Mm-hmm. And they started firing at 9 o'clock sharp. They began to fire on them. And
that was the Third Army firing on the Germans.
Yeah.
Yeah, trying to liberate the camp.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They started running them out and started getting with them. Mm-hmm. And so at 12 o'clock, all the Germans that was living was out of that town. And they had blown the bridge up.
Mm-hmm. The Germans blew up the bridge.
Going out,
okay. Yeah. To slow down the American, or the Allies, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then 2 hours after they did that, they had another pontoon bridge up ready to go.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And somebody said, well, what do you remember about this? I said, well, the first thing I remember was this soldier started climbing this pole. And he took the German flag down. Then he put up one of these big flags, like a car dealer in the United States had when I got back.
Uh-huh.
A big, big flag, about, I don't know how long it was. And I said, the wind got it and whipped it out like that and stood straight out.
Is it an American flag?
Yeah. And I said, that's the biggest group of men I've ever seen in my life. It was crying, and I was one of them. And my brother was one of them. And, but this cousin of mine, that was his aide, had been looking for me and my brother. He found out that we was in the camp. And he came up there, and they wouldn't let it, they still locked the camp down. They told us, they said, now, you don't get out of this camp till we say get out.
That was the Third Army people?
Yeah.
Okay.
Don't get out. Then he came up there and got us when we could get out. Took us down to his outfit, and he said that he asked us what kind of trip did y'all have when you walked down there, Leonard? I said, oh, we had a bad time. I said, we were out in the open all the time, except the first day we got into the Krakow, And I said it was cold. And I told him what we did about marching around the borders and that. And I said from the time he walked in the door to the time he walked out, it took you 30 minutes to go in there to get warm. Mm-hmm. And I said, that's the only time we were in the building. And till we got to Mooseburg, and we didn't have too much there, but they did have a building or two there. And my brother came in on the 15th. And I had a little muffin tin and had cooked him a little muffin cake and had one candle on it. It was his birthday, April the 15th.
Wow, and the camp was liberated.
Yeah.
Wow.
He had got there the day before.
Day before, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. And, but, it was something I don't want to go through again. I wouldn't take a penny for what I've been through. Mm-hmm. And I've had a good life, and the Lord's still blessing me every day. Mm-hmm.
What was it like when were you able to, Mr. Gordy, go with your brother to be with your mom again?
Yeah, we came home and he went back to college, but he couldn't get what he was wanting down at Florida. But he knew this professor over there, and this professor had a brother up at University of North Carolina. Hmm. Paul was going to get into marketing, and he had a brother up there that taught marketing, and he called him and he told him he'd like for him to see if he couldn't make room for him up there. He said, yeah. Says, you send him up here. And Paul went up there and said, because I had bought me a new 41 Chevrolet that didn't have but about 3,000 miles on it. And I brought it from Mariana down to Gainesville. I gave mother the title to it. I said, Mama, take care of this car. And I said, she had a Mercury convertible.
Oh.
And I said, it's the first new car I've ever had. Mm. And she said, and I said, take care of it, and if something happens to me, it's yours. And this is the title, and I signed it where I was supposed to sign. And I don't know what's going to happen. And she got the telegram from the War Department. And they didn't see a shoot open. That's the reason they said that I was killed.
I was going to ask you, when did your mother find out that you were alive?
She found out about 2 or 3 weeks after.
Okay, so after she thought that you had been killed, but then a few weeks later she was able to, were you able to write her?
Yeah, we were able to write her. My brother had fixed up a package for him when I came and brought my car down from Marana. Mm-hmm. And I helped Mama package up stuff for Paul, and we sent it to him.
You already?
He was in the camp at that time, already assigned to a camp.
You knew he was in the camp?
Yeah. But
Well, Mr. Gordy, I know we've been talking now for well over an hour, and I've learned so much from listening to you talk about your experiences, and I want to thank you for talking, and thank you for your service to our country. And did you have any other thoughts that you wanted to share about your thoughts about the war? Or
well, when we came home, we had to go down to Miami to be discharged. We got down there, and the major says, "Gordy," he says, you boys have got special orders on your discharges." He says, "I want to tell you," says, "both of you guys have gotten combat wounds and combat things that have happened to you during combat that have hurt you. Said y'all have been awarded 25%. Said, won't you start getting this when you get home?" Said, "Go to your veteran officer up there and tell him and show him what you got here."
25% disability?
Disability.
Okay.
And I said, "Major, I've got a good job to go to. And I appreciate you telling us this." I said, I'm not going to take it. I said, "I don't deserve it." And I said, "Up to this time, we made everything our way." Well, he said, "You were in this too." I said, "Well, that's all right." I said, I know I've earned it, but I don't need it right now. And I said, and he said, "Listen," I said, "go and let me tell you something." Says, "You boys are young now. You're not going to always be young." And I said, "Well, I'll tell you what," I said, "I appreciate this," but I said, "I don't think I want to take it." And for 50 years, about 55 years, I gave him $200,000, the government. And I didn't take it, but I'm taking disability now. And I have only had it about 4 years.
Wow.
But I had a mail contract that I was connected with the post office for 28 years. I was a prime contractor for 20 years. And I ran about 6 semis. Hauling mail for the post office, and they have got one of the best records safety records all during that time, the 28 years.
That's great.
That I was the contract. Ms. Mayo had the contract. Her husband had a heart attack and died. She inherited it. And I was district manager for the Gannett Life Insurance Company here. I had 23 agents in my office. And she was about... She was about 85 years old whenever I bought a truck and leased it to her. And she had a colored driver that had worked for her husband. And his daddy was a driver for him too. But we had a straight job, and I bought a Simmons International. Two-ton truck. And with a new body and everything on it, and leased it to her. And then I bought another straight job. And it was a diesel, the first one was a gas.
Okay.
And so whenever we went, I can't think of a word what I lose myself on this. So, but well, anyway, we had bought this new diesel, and Mr. Knapp was the president, and he had inherited this insurance company from his daddy up at Climax, Georgia, and he had it in Jacksonville. And I had worked for him about 11 years altogether. And the last 4 or 5 years, I was district manager for him. And they had the highest collection percentage of anybody with this company.
Wow, that's great.
We had 98.5 collection percentage. And we didn't always have, we won several trips, several things that they had. And, We did a good business and straight business. I wouldn't let them put stuff on the books
that right.
couldn't collect money for.
Right.
And he says, I didn't know you was in the mail business. I said, I got a truck that I leased to Ms. Mail, and I'm not in the mail business. He's paying me $35 a year. He said, I don't like anybody working for me that I'm paying this kind of money to. I said, why didn't you tell me? I said, you never have asked me. He said, well, I'm asking you now. I said, well, I'll tell you now. I've never had to. I controlled the drivers, and I put the drivers that I want to on my truck. But I said, I'm not doing this, and I haven't mistreated you at all. And I said, now, since you asked me, I've never been on a mail truck. A day. And he said, well, I just don't want anybody I'm paying this kind of money to have anything else. I said, well, now you ask me now. I said, it's all right, you can send somebody down here if you want to. I'll help you any way I can. But I says, I tell you what, I'm giving you 2 weeks notice now. Hmm. I'll have a letter in your, on your desk Monday morning. And his son-in-law was agency director. And he told him what he'd done. He said, oh my God, you've done the wrong thing. And he says, well, I'm not gonna pay anybody that kind of money. And him being the mayor of Tennessee, he says, I could have told you that if you ask him for it, he's told you the same thing. He said, well, I checked it out and said, that's right. Says he hadn't been on the mail truck. And said he hadn't slowed up on his business at all with us. Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, and what he's collecting is the bottom line.
Yeah. Hmm.
So I did, I resigned. Mm-hmm. Then I got into the mail business. And it wasn't long that before he was wanting to talk to me about going back. I said, no, I don't want to go back.
Right.
I said, well, I want to go back now for $35,000.
Right.
I make that much in it's Christmas time. I make about $30,000 extra during Christmas time, putting trucks on the road. Mm-hmm.
It's such an important job. My wife actually retired out of the post office.
She did?
She was a letter carrier for 25 mm-hmm. years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I had a good record with them. And I wasn't stowing to them at all.
Right. Well, Mr. Gordy, I want to thank you for your time, and this has been really educational, and I know that that students are going to find it very interesting to listen to, and they're going to learn a lot from it.
Well, I have been down to Dunellen and been around. I've been active with the Lions Club,
mm-hmm.
University Lions Club here, and we're the only club. I'm not in it now. I'm still a member of it, but we're the only Lions Club in Gainesville that's got a clubhouse.
Oh, wow.
We got a clubhouse out here on
We're here.
We're just kind of wrapping up. I'll go ahead and